You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, listeners, very pleased to bring on Jeffrey Miller. You might know his name. He's actually quite a frequent commentator in media, amongst many things. He's a geopolitical analyst for the Democracy Project. I think of him as a bit of a foreign affairs expert as well. And he's doing his PhD currently at the University of Otago, focusing in the Middle East in particular. But Jeffrey has a wide view. And so we're bringing him on the show today. So, Jeffrey, welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Simon.
Well, thank you. And look, thanks for the commentary you're bringing into this sector. My listeners will know, and you know, you and I have talked before, I think we need more conversations about what's happening outside of New Zealand. So thank you for the work you're leading in that space.
It's a pleasure, and I can only agree with that.
Excellent. And that's the interview. No, only kidding. we were talking the potential impact of the United States or the US election on New Zealand and around the Indo-Pacific. And I thought that was a really interesting topic. So it's a big one. So I'm going to throw it over to you. What, you know, when you look at what's happening in America at the moment, Trump and Harris, what is that going to mean for New Zealand and our neighbours in the Pacific?
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it? It's only 2 months away, the US elections, and so much has happened in the last six weeks or so. You think of the assassination attempt on Donald Trump, Joe Biden withdrawing from the race, Kamala Harris taking over, and I think we're all just a bit, we've had so much to digest with all of everything that's gone on. Just the fact that Kamala Harris is there and not Joe Biden, and we had that Democratic National Convention, the coronation, if you like, of Kamala Harris as the candidate. And we haven't actually got to actually thinking about some of the foreign policy implications and how this could affect New Zealand. I mean, the fact is we're going to have a new president, whoever it is. It's either going to be Kamala Harris or it's going to be Donald Trump. And we don't know who's going to be the winner. I had a look at the polls over the weekend, and that there's a 1.8% percentage point advantage to Kamala Harris in the average of polls from Real Clear Politics at the moment. But the website helpfully noted that on the same day back in 2016, Hillary Clinton had a 4.9% advantage over Donald Trump. And of course, we know what happened that year. So I think it's anyone's guess as to what happens. I think at the moment, yes, Kamala Harris probably has some momentum coming out of that Democratic National Convention, but there's still a debate to come on the 10th of September. And there's always the potential of surprises, or the October surprise, as Americans often talk about. And yeah, you only have to think of what happened last October, October the 7th, to think of the kind of surprises that can happen in the foreign policy space. And just given what a powder keg the Middle East is at the moment, and you know, not to forget Ukraine, not to forget our own region in the Indo-Pacific. So there's so much that could happen between now and the election. But I think it's just a really interesting thought experiment to think about, you know, what will happen if Kamala Harris becomes president, or if Donald Trump becomes president, and particularly in New Zealand's region.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and first and foremost, as you say, it's fascinating to watch what's happening in the US. And I'm pleased you actually listed off some of the events, because each of those you mentioned, like from the assassination to Biden stepping down, those are huge in themselves, and yet we've had multiple ones. I think what's going to be fascinating, as a quick aside, is, you know, you get the polls and popular vote, but then we also know there's a few swing seats, or states rather. I mean, it's just, I don't know, I'm a bit of a political junkie, as you'd imagine. But as you say, you know, come the election, we're going to have either Kamala Harris or Donald Trump. And I mean, what do we know about either or both of them in terms of their relationship with New Zealand? Do they know where it is? Do they care? Do they show deep interest?
Well, look, let's start with Donald Trump, because I think in many ways it's easier to read the Donald Trump foreign policy playbook. We kind of know what Donald Trump stands for in foreign policy terms. We know that he's very focused on China. So I think if Donald Trump were to retake the White House, he would pick up largely where he left off in 2020. I think he would have a very aggressive approach to China. He's promising 60% tariffs this time around. He introduced tariffs back in his first term of up to 25%, which interestingly, Joe Biden kept in place. In fact, the Biden administration added new tariffs to against China. So Donald Trump is promising an even tougher line when it comes to China. He's going to be very tough on Iran, very much in lockstep behind Israel. I think when it comes to Ukraine, he said that the war will be over within 24 hours. He's going to go and talk some sense into Putin, essentially, I think is Donald Trump's view on this. I'm not sure, actually, what would happen under a Trump administration with Ukraine. There are some arguments from both sides. He did actually acquiesce to a big spending package to help Ukraine earlier in the year. So I don't think it's as simple as, Donald Trump comes in and on January 20th and signs over Ukraine to Russia, as some perhaps some of Donald Trump's opponents would be like to believe, would like voters to believe. So, but when it comes to the Middle East, I think it's quite simple with Donald Trump. It's going to be backing Israel to the hilt and taking a very tough line on Iran. Remember, Trump tore up the nuclear deal with Iran. I think it's very clear what his positions would be in the Middle East. When it comes to the Indo-Pacific as well, an aggressive stance towards China. AUKUS, I guess, is one of the big questions when it comes to New Zealand. That was a Biden initiative, but I think it's one that Donald Trump could certainly live with and perhaps expand further, mould to his own ends. But I think it would not come without costs for New Zealand. Donald Trump was very keen on making NATO countries pay their share back when he was president, and he really wanted the likes of Germany to increase their defence spending by a large magnitude. So I think if Trump took the White House, he would be telling New Zealand, you've got to spend way more on defence. If you want to have any part of, being in AUKUS Pillar 2, I think he would be saying no free ride for the likes of New Zealand. You're not just coming here to sign your name to be on the list. Now, look, New Zealand is moving in that direction. New Zealand is increasing its defence spending, or it's been signalled, but it's taking a long time coming. And I'm not sure Donald Trump would be up for New Zealand, extending deadlines on its defence capability plans and having another review and another working group to work out exactly what it's going to spend on. I think he would want New Zealand to spend quickly on defence. So that's Donald
Trump. He's a man of action, if you will, on that front, not waving the flag for him per se.
He's blunt. Yeah. And I think, look, the Biden administration largely took over a lot of Donald Trump's policies on China. This is the irony. Donald Trump talked really tough on China, and a lot of Democrats and opponents of Trump said, how terrible this is. Let's get the grown-ups in the room and we'll run foreign policy in a different way. And yet, largely Donald Trump's approach to China has been Biden's approach to China. Biden has institutionalized it and has breathed life into, the likes of AUKUS or started AUKUS. He's kept the Quad going. He started up new groupings, Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, Partners in the Blue Pacific, a US Pacific Islands Summit. And so Biden has only strengthened Donald Trump's China policy. Perhaps where it has changed somewhat is the tone. In the end, neither Joe Biden nor Kamala Harris are Trump-like in the way that they speak and act. They talk tough, but perhaps not on that, perhaps in the particularly crude, blunt manner that we know that Trump is known for. But
yeah,
largely,
exactly right.
There's a lot of commonality between Donald Trump now and the Joe Biden administration, which is also the Kamala Harris administration. And in the end, Kamala Harris is an incumbent. It's an interesting situation because we will have a new president, and yet she's also an incumbent, being the vice president. She's hardly going to repudiate what her administration has been up to in the Indo-Pacific. So I can't really see a huge walking back. Whoever becomes the president, whether it's Donald Trump, whether it's Kamala Harris, I think a lot of the policy towards the Indo-Pacific will continue. But there may be slightly different focuses. I mean, when it comes to the Pacific and emphasizing climate change, I can't really see Donald Trump going around and saying, we need to do lots more to help the Pacific countries and help them combat rising sea levels and climate change. I don't think that's Donald Trump's strategy. I think he would just go and talk tough to China. So he might just cut to the chase, because in a sense, when it comes to the Biden administration, they like to sort of couch things and sort of in these terms saying, oh, it's all about climate change, that's why the US is being invested in the Pacific. Well, look, we know that's not why the US is being involved. I mean, it's great if Pacific countries get some help with rising sea levels and help them combat the effects of climate change, because it is affecting the Pacific. But that's not why the US is getting involved, or Australia and New Zealand, really, seriously. It's all about China and the fact that China, is taking quite an assertive approach to New Zealand's region in the Pacific. And so that's why the US and Australia, UK, New Zealand, others are becoming very interested in the Pacific. And you saw that at the Pacific Islands Forum.
I was going to say, well, China, if we're reading the reports correctly, has or is trying to strong arm the Pacific Island Forum to remove its communique at the end, because it talks about Taiwan. So yeah, there's a real geopolitical tension.
Absolutely. And look, we can't be blind to this. I think New Zealanders do need to really think about this when it comes to the debate. China is New Zealand's biggest trading partner by far, $38 billion worth of two-way trade, $20 billion New Zealand dollars in exports go to China every year. So, New Zealand doesn't have necessarily a free hand. New Zealand can sign up to whatever it wants, but it has to expect some level of repercussions. And if New Zealand does go in and signs up to AUKUS, I think that will be the point that China really responds to New Zealand. And the risk for New Zealand is that none of these arrangements, whether it's AUKUS, Partners in the Blue Pacific, even the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, none of them come with trade guarantees for New Zealand of any serious consequence. It's not that the US is giving New Zealand a free trade deal in exchange for signing up to AUKUS at all. So there's no trade guarantee. There's no security guarantee either, by the way, Simon. No. So AUKUS is like an alliance without being an alliance. It doesn't have the benefits in a way that ANZUS did for New Zealand. ANZUS had the benefits of a security guarantee. So yes, you were part of an alliance, but you got something for your money, in the sense that the United States was duty bound to come to New Zealand's aid if New Zealand were the subject of the target of military aggression.
And I think that's really important
It's a very important distinction. AUKUS comes with the feels, in a sense, that you feel that you're all working together and there's great solidarity. You're working with Australia, the UK, US, and these old partners, or like-minded partners, as they're often being called nowadays. But it doesn't come with a security guarantee. And I think if New Zealand is going to go down this route, and look, I'm a noted skeptic on these things. I like the independent foreign policy. I like the fact New Zealand sort of can get on with everyone. But look, if New Zealand is going to go down this more hawkish path, I think New Zealand needs to stand up for itself a bit more and ask for something for its money and talk tough a bit to the likes of the United States and say, look, if you want us in this, you're going to have to give us something in exchange, because New Zealand is exposing itself to enormous geopolitical risk if it gets involved with the likes of AUKUS. I don't think this is unprecedented, because I think if you look at Christopher Luxon, he talks a lot now about security and trade being intertwined. And if you look at the United States, they've given free trade deals in the past to Gulf states. The likes of Bahrain and Oman have got free trade deals with the United States. Now, you tell me that that's not about security, certainly not about trade. These are tiny markets. It's not that it's that the US discovered, oh, look, we better have a free trade deal with these countries because they are enormous. You know, with the greatest of respect to Bahrain and Oman, these lovely countries that I've visited in the Gulf. My PhD thesis is on New Zealand's relations with the Gulf states. But they've got, as I say, they've shored themselves up, in a sense, because they've got that trading element as well. New Zealand hasn't. New Zealand hasn't got a free trade deal with the United States. Australia has, by the way. New Zealand got very close with the Comprehensive and Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership, or CPTPP, but that was nixed at the last minute by Donald Trump. So as things stand, New Zealand has no free trade deal with the US and is not likely to get one. I think that's a problem if New Zealand is going to go down this more alliance-light path.
Well, that's where I see an opportunity. I mean, I've been banging on for years when I was in Parliament to both you know, the Biden administration and the Trump administration, you know, for what little Simon O'Connor, chair of foreign affairs, was thinking. But it was telling them, you know, a free trade agreement's not just about trade, it's about security. And it's, you know, sad, if not frustrating to me, that one of our closest allies, we don't have a free trade deal. And, you know, I personally would like to see the current government spend more time focusing on trying to get that and leveraging off the AUKUS type requests.
I agree. And I think New Zealand at some point might need to have a rethink. If it gets to the point where New Zealand is ready to sign up to AUKUS Pillar 2 and there is no trade component of that forthcoming, then New Zealand might have to say to the US, look, perhaps we agree to disagree on this point. And New Zealand perhaps is going to have to rethink its positioning on this. And, you know, where does it get New Zealand? If it just gets New Zealand a whole lot of geopolitical risk, if it gets China coming down on New Zealand like a ton of bricks with the $20 billion worth of trade, I mean, that would put New Zealand into a world of hurt, a deep recession. All the milk powder exports suddenly stop from New Zealand. You know, where does that leave New Zealand when it comes to paying for schools, roads, hospitals? It leaves New Zealand up a creek without a paddle. So New Zealand might say, well, look, this is just, we can't go there. If you can't give us a trade deal, if you can't shore us up militarily, this is too much risk for us. Perhaps we need to find another path. And that might go back to the more de-escalatory approach, the dialogue, diplomacy kind of route. And that's really what I'm more of an advocate of, that New Zealand is a small state. Is even from the US perspective, New Zealand is actually better off not just signing up to these big alliances or alliance-like formations. New Zealand is actually in a good position to play the middleman, if you like, to keep the dialogue open, the channels of communication open. Yeah, New Zealand has good relations with China, good relations with the US, good relations with all these great powers. And New Zealand can be a little go-between when things get quite heated to stop conflict breaking out and to try and resolve some of the differences that these countries have a bit more amicably. I think New Zealand can probably do more to contribute down that route. But I admit that I'm perhaps becoming more of a minority voice in that camp, because overall, there does seem to be a real bipartisan move in New Zealand, whether it's Labour under Andrew Little, in particular as the previous Minister of Defence, and Chris Hipkins, or Christopher Luxon, now Winston Peters. They do seem to be wanting to take New Zealand down more the path of, you know, being closer with that Western bloc and the US in the end.
As someone... See, I'm someone who leans more in that direction, but actually I'm in full agreement with you, though, that New Zealand's got to get benefits from it. It's long and short. When you've got a major trading partner like China, if we're going to annoy them intentionally, which will be how it's perceived if we sign up to the likes of AUKUS, then, yeah, we'd expect a lot more to come from it. So, I mean, just jumping in, because obviously we've touched – quite well, obviously, in the general terms, we've talked on Trump. What do we know of Kamala Harris and her views of the Indo-Pacific? You've hinted a little bit, obviously, she's Biden-aligned, but has she travelled down here and all of this sort of stuff?
Look, she's made 17 trips abroad since she became vice president. Before that, she was a junior senator and, of course, a prosecutor, we know, in California. Her foreign policy experience is limited to a degree, so I think she's going to be quite reliant on advisors. I mean, Joe Biden, by contrast, you know, spent 50 years in the Senate, was the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He knew everything about foreign policy, that as far as the things he was interested in. But Kamala Harris, she has an advisor called Philip Gordon, who seems to be in line to be her national security advisor. He's more of an Atlanticist at heart. He speaks French, Italian, German, and he wrote his thesis on his PhD on French defense policy. He became a bit more interested in the Middle East later on in life, but he's seen as a pragmatist in that he doesn't want the US to get involved in regime change. He wrote a book that was very critical of US foreign policy in the Middle East over the decades, saying that, you know, the US needs to just do less and just be a bit more humble about things and not think that it's always going to just win the day. And so, but he, as I say, at heart, he seems to be a pragmatist. He was in favor of bombing Syria after Bashar al-Assad used chemical weapons back in whenever it was, 2012, I think, or 2013. But he also said to his colleagues, you know, Assad's going to stay in power here, and that seemed to raise the heckles of his counterparts who thought at that point that Assad was going to be toppled. So,
and he was right.
You know, he was right. So he's a pragmatist, which is a bit interesting because I think we used in perhaps US foreign policy to them taking the position more that, you know, the US is the greatest country in the world and what the US wants is something we need to aim for. I mean, I'm sort of drawing broad brush strokes here, but he's less ideological, perhaps. He's going to be the key advisor, it seems. He's likely to be that national security advisor. In terms of a Secretary of State, possibly Kurt Campbell could be in line for that. He's Deputy Secretary of State, and he was here in New Zealand just late last week. He's been very much the architect of Joe Biden's policies towards the Indo-Pacific. So it could well
be. So, in a sense, it sounds like she's going to lean more heavily on these advisors and their direction. But do you sort of feel then from what you've said that with the lead, God, I've forgotten his name, Johnson, was it? Is he going to lean more towards, as you say, the Atlantic in Europe than looking into the Indo-Pacific? Yeah,
Philip Gordon. So he's Gordon, known to be what they call an Atlanticist, so more Europe-focused. He was, you know, head of European affairs under Obama. It could well be that the US just decides to do less. I mean, look at what they're facing at the moment. Everything that's going on in the Indo-Pacific, that was their strategy when they came in 2020, was to focus on the Indo-Pacific. But, you know, there's a saying, isn't there, the quotation from Mike Tyson, that everyone's got a plan until you get punched in the face. And the US got punched in the face in a big way in February 2022 when Russia invaded Ukraine. And then it got punched in the face again last October the 7th when Hamas attacked Israel in that brutal attack there. And so suddenly the US has found itself fighting three crises, broad crises in a sense. This geopolitical competition in the Indo-Pacific, number one, competition with China, number two, Russia and Ukraine, number three, the Middle East. It's an enormous agenda, and the US may well say, well, we want to do less. So the war in Ukraine, I think, is probably going to be wound up whatever happens next year, because the amount of funding that is going into it is probably unsustainable. Germany wants to cut down its funding. I think the US as well, it's put in huge amounts of money, but is probably willing to look at some other options. So maybe that gets wrapped up in the next 6 months, in the next year, maybe 6 to 12 months. The Middle East as well, I think the war will probably be over by the time that the next president enters the White House. I think there will be a ceasefire in place. I think things will look quite different. I don't think they'll look great in the sense I don't think there will be a long-term solution as such, but it will be different to now where you're waking up each day and there's been, you know, another 50 people killed. So I think Harris, maybe when it comes to the Middle East, she looks at the long-term two-state solution and this kind of diplomacy, but it will be a different kind of management perhaps to this crisis situation we're experiencing now.
It may be, and this is just sort of a final thought from my side, that in some ways, as you mentioned, the three big areas, it's stretching America in all regards. You can see perhaps a Trumpian-type approach is to be more belligerent, front-footed, aggressive. Obviously, he wants to pull back and save money, but much more, you know, America first. Whereas, you know, Harris may be much more, okay, we have to pull back where we can and work in the more diplomatic space. But probably not articulating that so well. I mean, Trump is all about himself and making sure he's leading and being seen to lead, where Harris might be a bit more, I don't know, subtle, partly because she's not as engaged and leaving that up to her advisors and experts. But I thought one last point to share, we were talking before we came on air, is the American military buildup in the Middle East. So bringing you back to your PhD area, is the largest since, is it 1970, or since the 1970s?
Yeah, largest since 1973, apparently, like the US naval build up, all those aircraft carriers and so forth. The US presence in the Middle East at the moment is just immense. And there are just some things in the Middle East now that it's become normalized. I mean, the Suez Canal is almost non-functional now. The fact that the Houthis are launching these constant attacks that really have not stopped, despite, you know, New Zealand's involved in what's called Operation Poseidon Archer, this US-UK campaign against the Houthi rebels, which has reduced somewhat the Houthis' capability to send out drones and missiles, but hasn't stopped it completely. So, you know, commercial ships are avoiding the going through the Suez Canal. They're going around the coast of Africa instead. And, you know, we've just kind of accepted this. It's 30%. Well, thereabouts of Egypt's income, the revenues it gets from the Suez Canal each year. It's adding huge amount of shipping times and costs, no doubt, for shipping all around the world. But we've just become used to, I think, a more crisis situation coming out of COVID, because that was all normal during COVID. It was normalized, the idea that you have shipping delays and you have to wait longer for your packages from Amazon or AliExpress or whatever. And all through our economies, you know, we've moved away from perhaps a just-in-time mentality to one where you've got to, you know, make provisions in case something doesn't arrive. So we've become accustomed to a crisis situation. I don't think that's healthy in a way. We shouldn't be in this constant crisis mentality. It would be nice to be much more optimistic about the world, but it's hard sometimes, isn't it, Simon? When you look at what's going on, when you just read the news each day, it's pretty bleak. And I guess that's why Christopher Luxon in New Zealand is reacting in the way it is. It's taking a more security-focused approach to its foreign policy in a way that it just hasn't done for decades, that defence ties, military ties, security is becoming the focus of a lot of New Zealand's foreign policy engagement over and above trade. It's quite new for New Zealand to be looking at the world in this way after sort of 30 years of looking at the world through free trade agreements primarily and optimism.
Yeah, well, and sadly, I think it is that, you know, the free trade architecture is breaking down. And so that is causing a rethink across the political parties. But it's why having these sort of conversations with experts like yourself, I think, is so valuable. As I said right at the start, I think New Zealanders need to think and discuss foreign policy a lot more, because just using your Egyptian example, the closure or near closure of the Suez Canal is not something thousands of miles away of no impact. It does impact us, cost and time. But Geoffrey, speaking of time, I am incredibly grateful for all the time you've given us, and actually would love to have you back sometime, because actually I've always appreciated your views into this space. So again, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Simon. It's good chat. Take care.
So that was Geoffrey Miller, geopolitical analyst for the Democracy Project and currently PhD candidate at Otago.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.